One.
All right, I'd like to call to order the City Tacoma Infrastructure Planning Sustainability Committee meeting of August 25th, 2021. Clerk, will you please call the roll?
Councilmember Beal?
Here.
Councilmember Hunter?
Here.
Vice Chair Walker?
Here.
Chair McCarthy?
Here. Welcome. Fellow committee members and the watching and listening public. Lost my glasses in the last 3 minutes, so please bear with me. So tonight we're talking about the non-interim regulations. Again, this will be our eighth meeting talking about the non-interim regulations. In addition to those eight meetings, we held four breakout meetings to talk about fossil fuels with representatives from the environmental community in the energy industry community. So we have this meeting and our meeting Monday, August 30th, to finish our work. We're getting closer here. Let me just kind of walk through the tentative plan for tonight and then next week. So tonight, we're going to review the updated proposals as they relate to fossil fuels and expanded SEPA as prepared by staff. On Monday, we'll...
It's really hard to hear you. And I don't know if that's just me, but...
Let me...
Turn my volume all the way up and I can barely hear you.
Okay, let me... Give me a sec here.
Okay, can you hear me now? Okay, sorry, headset's not working. I just wear the headset so that, you know, the Simpsons are kind of loud in the next room. So that's my reason. But in any event, our tentative plan is tonight we're going to review the updated fossil fuel proposals and expanded SEPA. Monday we'll review residential and chemical. I think we're going to just take all the votes Monday on the proposed amendments. Staff was working on the updated fossil fuel language. They weren't able to finish that until just a few hours ago, or less, really. First of all, thank you, Steve Victor and Peter Huffman, for working on it. But I want to be respectful to all my colleagues and everyone else who cares, and there's quite a few, to give an appropriate level of time for people to review the language that you all are going to see today. I just got a text that says something different than I thought in terms of the hard stop for tonight. So in any event, I think the plan is, unless the committee feels differently after tonight's proposals, to just take all the votes Monday. The residential and chemical, so the fossil fuel amendments we see tonight that Steve's going to walk us through, at least the draft proposals, those will be, after this meeting, they'll be posted online and so available to the public to review before Monday's meeting. Chemical and residential, Steve and Peter are working really hard on those. Those should be done. Our goal is like tomorrow by the end of the day. And so when those are done, we'll figure out how to circulate those. I think Peter's going to put it in the letter that goes out to the public. After we're done taking votes on Monday, it will send it to the full council with our recommendations to the full council. My understanding after a couple conversations with the mayor is that the Puyallup tribe wants to consult directly either with the full council or with the mayor's office. So the mayor has Once she receives our recommendations, she'll then be taking the lead to navigate the appropriate consultation process with the Puyallup tribe. And then once that's done, at some point, the mayor, as she manages the agenda, will be putting this item back on the agenda for the full council consideration. I don't know if we'll schedule a study session or committee of the whole yet. That might happen, might not. My understanding is there will probably have to be a public hearing, and then eventually the council will vote on it. So needless to say, after these amendments leave this committee, there are still several steps before anything becomes codified by the city. And just as a reminder to my colleagues and to everybody who's watching, whatever the full council ends up passing over the course of the next, I don't know, month or so, will be superseded by the sub-area plan and the work of the sub-area group. I do want to, before we start, and I also want to add, when the regardless of what this committee pushes out to the full council, the full council has all the liberties in the world to consider what we propose and or anything else any council member wants considered. So just so that's clear. And by that, I mean, what we push out of this committee, it does not limit the scope of what the council may consider. But we were tasked with a short timeline to work through this and hand something to the full council. And that's what we're going to do. I did want to give a big thank you to Citizens for a Healthy Bay, Washington Environmental Council, the Sustainable Tacoma Commission, the Port of Tacoma, South Sound Community Military Partnership, Sound Terminal, U.S. Oil, and PSE for all sitting around the table. Three to four times to just have a high level and sometimes very detailed discussion about issues which are extremely important and in many ways extremely controversial. And I want to be absolutely clear that while there was no consensus reached in those discussions, I think those discussions had a lot of value because the environmental community and the energy community are going to be working on these issues for years to come. And so getting around the table and being able to kind of work through the different positions and options, I think really puts our entire community in a better position and really kind of hopefully provide some sort of framework for the sub-area plan work moving forward. Once the council votes on the non-interim regulations, the sub-area commission really the bulk of the work is with them to take whatever the non-interim regulations say and work on, you know, something that's going to be a lot longer lasting and hopefully better for our entire community. So with that, again, tonight, Steve's going to walk us through the fossil fuel amendments, drafts, and expanded SEPA. And then after that, I did want to open it up. I know just my colleague, Councilmember Beal, if there's any other items on the table you think we should be considering, if you want to bring those up, I would. I think given everything I said, our preference is to just do all the voting on Monday, but then again, if any of the draft amendments that are on the table tonight seem acceptable, or at least are in a fashion that everyone here feels comfortable voting tonight, then I'd say we do it. But so I'm thinking we'll play that by ear just a little bit, with the default being waiting till Monday. Okay, I talked too much. Steve, do you want to pull up? Do you want to share these amendments and then you can walk through them, or what do you think?
Chair, I absolutely will do that. But before I talk about that, if with your indulgence, I would like to talk about some things that came up in the course of the discussions with stakeholder groups that you will not see included and why those are not included.
So, Steve, can I pause you for a second? Because Councilmember Hunter had her hand up here.
I'm sorry, Chair. I just jumped into what you were talking about there. But just as part of formality, did we do roll call to make sure that we launched the meeting appropriately, or was...
Let's do roll call. Who's here?
Because these are important topics that we're discussing here, and I don't want a technicality that we didn't officially start the meeting appropriately to interfere with
this.
And maybe it's I've got Council Member Walker here telling me that we did do roll call. Are we good, Christina?
I think so. I defer to the clerk, but yes.
We did do roll call, but I would be happy to call roll again.
No, I'm good. And I apologize, Mr. Chair, just a stickler for detail there.
Belts and suspenders.
Engage here. All right. I'm sorry, Mr. Victor. Thank you.
Yep. Councilmember Beal.
I just wanted to say on Monday, I have a hard end time.
Okay.
For 6 p.m. And I was texting with Claire and realize and understand that the meeting hasn't been scheduled yet. So for consideration of just going through amendments and trying to vote on all of them Monday, I'm going to suspect that 90 minutes is not going to be enough time. I can do probably as early as 3:45, which I guess I'm a little bit worried that might not be enough time either. But I've got a small window of time on Monday, unfortunately.
Yeah. So, Councilmember Beal, so I thought your window was tonight, but the Claire just texted me and said, no, it's Monday. So I guess we can go as long as we want tonight then, but Monday I can meet any time. So maybe let's just see where we get, you know, as I was talking, Claire texted me and said, no, his heart stops on Monday. So, I must have read the email wrong earlier. So I'm cool with going as late tonight as we want to go. I agree. You know, Monday, I'm happy to meet as early as people can meet. So Claire, why don't we, when we schedule Monday, can we do 3:45? So it's at least 90 minutes more. So that gives us 3 hours, right? No. I'm doing this wrong. Hour and a half plus 45 minutes. No, to 2 hours and 15 minutes or something like that.
So we can, yes, I can certainly schedule it for 3:45.
Okay.
Then you would have just over 2 hours until Councilmember Beal would need to leave.
Yeah, I just don't want people to feel rushed. So I'll make myself available, you know, anytime. I know Councilmember Bill's got a day job and that's extremely demanding, so I empathize. So, okay, cool. Let's get as far as we can get tonight then, Steve.
So, Chair and members of the committee, before I launch into the draft amendments and proposed code, I wanted to talk about a few things that came up in the course of the stakeholder meetings that you will not see. In my opinion and Peter's opinion, these are issues that can and should be considered in the sub-area plan. And I know that members of this committee have been clear that the sub-area plan is going to occur and that these issues are going to be considered or reconsidered. So just for clarity, the first thing you won't see that came up in the course of the meetings is regulation of throughput, meaning quantities of transloading, transshipment, those sorts of things. As you heard in a prior meeting, I have legal concerns about regulating those on the basis of trying to regulate interstate or international commerce, but the question was raised, can we regulate that on the basis of safety here? And the answer is, I think we can. It always has some risk, but part of the question came from Whatcom County, which does indeed regulate transshipment and transloading facilities. But Whatcom County, in the course of developing the regulations, developed a lot of data about the particular hazards and risks of their area. And we have not done that in a specific way. I believe that's consultant work. I think Peter agrees with me. So that's why you won't see that issue embraced in any of these amendments. It can and probably should be considered in the subarea plan. The second issue that you won't see that came up is regulation establishing particular greenhouse gas targets for permitted fuels or reduction targets. And again, this is something that Whatcom did. But again, as with the first one, they did a lot of research and data and had consultant work done on that. So one option, I suppose, is to import their data, but we haven't done any of that work. And so that, again, I think is left for the subarea plan. And that could be an addition to an enhanced SEPA checklist if once the research and the work is done, but it isn't today in what you'll see. And finally, the question of industrial insurance came up. And that is the concept of requiring industry to provide insurance for hazards they create. And this is a topic that we did not get to in the stakeholder meetings. I don't know whether that is an issue or not. I don't know what other insurance the Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission requires. It's just there wasn't enough known to include that. So those are three issues that came up pretty consistently in the stakeholder meetings that you will not see tonight. And those are our reasons as staff for not including them. With that, unless there are questions on any of those topics, I will proceed with the draft amendments. So let me pause for questions.
Steve, on the insurance part, what would it take to research that? Because that's a common theme that we've heard over the years about fossil fuel uses, LNG, that type of thing, is that the city doesn't have enough liability protection with the people that we permit in the event of a disaster, explosion, whatever that might be. And it seems like a reasonable thing that we should be trying to protect ourselves with that. Seems like I thought Whatcom was doing it, but is there...
Whatcom is doing it. Absolutely.
What do we need to do to research this?
So, Councilmember, the first thing is ask industry. We never got to the point of even talking about it. It might not be an issue. The second point I would kind of split hairs a little bit. The city does not have, we do not have liability for activities that we permit. Liability remains on the applicant and on the permit holder. The question what Whatcom addressed was, did the industries carry sufficient insurance to cover damages to third parties, not insure the city for liability, but damage to third parties. I think we would want to do the analysis first. I don't know if that's an issue or not. Maybe that is not an issue for industry, and maybe they already carry through their licensing with WETC or others a lot of insurance. If it is, then I think we would want to do at least some analysis of the circumstances that exist in the port area so that we have a basis for saying this is the number that we think you need to carry for third-party liability.
Yeah, and I think we should do that because, I mean, as I understand it in sort of the breakout meetings with the panelists, that this was brought up. I know it was brought up, and I know it's been presented to staff. I just didn't know where we're at on it. It just seems like something reasonable that even if we had to call Whatcom and go, how did you guys do it?
Absolutely.
I don't know. I just want to see if we can get there because this has been, I know for Councilmember Walker hasn't been on the council as long. I feel like every time we've been yelled at about this stuff, about like an LNG disaster or something, it's, you know, the insurance thing comes up, and it's always been a curious thing to me that I've never looked into. So,
and often it's come up and been responded to by us in the context of the city having liability. And I've consistently said, we don't have liability, but the Whatcom example is different. It's for damage to third parties and even city facilities, for example. The reason, and I agree with you, Councilmember, and the reason that I highlighted these three things at the beginning of the presentation today is because I do think they should be considered in the sub-area plan, but we simply didn't have the time or the resources to do anything meaningful in the time that we had to work on this.
Can I ask a quick question real quick, just on the insurance piece? Because I'm looking at what was pitched. This was about insurance for the benefit of the city of Tacoma. That was what. So, Whatcom County doesn't say you need to insure, add the county as an additional insured, right? It says, what does it say?
Well, I don't have Whatcom in front of me, so I don't want to be too specific. But the tenor of what they did was to make sure that in the event of some major catastrophe, there was sufficient insurance to cover losses that were caused by it, as opposed to just say the city of Tacoma has permit liability because we don't.
So rather than what was pitched, at least as a first draft, which was named the city as an additional insured, it's more proof of insurance, right?
Yeah, that I think would be meaningful. I think it would be meaningful and appropriate to consider whether there is, and those of us that have worked in insurance know there's all kinds of complex loss formulas. And so some work needs to be done to establish in the context of our situation what that number would be. And as I said, to find out from the industry, maybe they already carry huge amounts of insurance under their licenses from the state. I don't know.
Well, I would bet my city salary that any bona fide company would carry some insurance. So I'm comfortable with the concept, but like what you said, Steve, we haven't talked about it. So maybe there's an opportunity between now and Monday to tease it out. Maybe not. Maybe we just kick it to the sub area. But
I mean, Chair and committee members, our hope is that the sub area plan can be completed in 2022. Now, Steve Atkinson's on vacation, so he can't, you know, send me kick under the table text messages. But, it's not a forever process. So any issues that are sent to the sub-area plan should be addressed in a reasonable amount of time.
Well, that's reassuring. That's the first I ever heard 2022. That's,
like I said, Steve Atkinson is on vacation, so he can get mad at me when he comes back. But I think that's that another year is including time at the end of this year. You know, I don't. But again, that's just me. So if anybody's held to account, it's me. So with that, I will share my screen, I think. Uh-huh. Did that work? Okay, it looks like it worked to me. Hearing that it did not work.
No, it worked. It worked.
Perfect. Okay, well, this is the first time I've done it because that is not my thing. So, so the first motion, as the committee will recall, was an evolution at 9 iterations, it would add, of how to define renewable fuels. And what we discovered in the course of working through this was that there is no single agreed definition of what a renewable fuel is. There are many components and combinations. And so as we discussed in an earlier meeting, the definition that we came up with is a collection of programs. And it is all types of fuel that are currently incentivized by the federal or state government as cleaner. So that includes, you know, principally any credit generating fuel under the Washington Clean Fuel Standard, which is supposed to be implemented in a little over a year. And credit generating, of course, means that they are clean enough to not require the payment of effectively a penalty. That will change over the course, over the life of the Clean Fuel Standard program. But this will be, in this iteration, for non-interim, will be as of the time of application. Any EPA-approved and listed fuel under this federal renewable fuel standard, and that is something that is a program regulated by EPA. And what this does is it approves, it reviews what they call the fuel pathway, which means how is the fuel made, and what are the impacts of both the process and the fuel itself. And this is primarily biomass fuels. But these biomass fuels in and of themselves are not used 100%. Today, there are none that are used 100%. So these are a blend, part of a blend, which leads us to C, D, C and D, which are the Washington state statutes that define renewable diesel as a blend and ethanol and E85 as blends, using, you know, ultimately the EPA-approved feedstocks blended with petroleum. And then finally, there's a separate cleaner vehicle fuel statute that includes natural gas, propane, hydrogen, electricity, and that has its own requirement. And as I mentioned previously when talking about this, the idea is to give permitting people some clear references. It does or it doesn't meet one of these. We're not creating a separate analysis that we have to do. And all of these, as I've mentioned before, are captured under the Washington Clean Fuel Standard. So regardless of whether they're listed in separate statutes, they will all either be credit generating or credit deficit, credit needing, I suppose the way to put it, during the life of that program through 2035. So that we talked about a number of definitions which collapse these, but none of them were as clear as listing these programs, and clear, I would say, from a permitting perspective. So the draft code, and I struggle when I share screen because I think it's just my own screen and I sometimes zip up and down. So if I make anybody nauseated, tell me, you know, we're all looking at your screen, Victor. Starting with the definitions. So cleaner fuels are exactly what you saw above, just stated as we would a definition in a code. I specifically included hydrogen in two places just to ensure that the Tacoma Public Utilities concern about regulating out hydrogen was addressed, whether or not that ends up being considered a chemical. It's considered a fuel in this definition, and so it would be available. A permittable fuel. Throughout the code, draft code, we talked about the enhanced CEPA review. And so this is the next definition. And what we're proposing is that we have, the director has the opportunity through a director's rule, meaning the Planning and Development Services Director, to add and to update to that definition. But we included minimum requirements. So public meeting for the CEPA application, which occurs after the determination of completeness of the application, before the issuance of any preliminary threshold determination, expanded notice distribution list, expanded public notification distance, expanded notification comment period. And Councilmember Beal, these are things that I know that you were, and all of us were concerned about. So we wanted to make sure that they were not lost and that these are the, sort of the mandatory minimums. And then a supplemental checklist specific to CEPA review of fuel production or chemical manufacturing. And here we haven't developed that. So that is why it's in there in the form that it's in. And things like GHG thresholds that might be developed as part of the subarea plan could be included in this. But for now, this is the proposed definition of enhanced CEPA review. Then going to expanded cleaner fuel infrastructure, we hit on that term because, as I said, the term renewables wasn't meaningful. So expanded cleaner fuel infrastructure means anything that is involved with the expansion, storage, or infrastructure of cleaner fuels as we've defined them. Now, this was interesting because you'll see there is a difference between expanded cleaner fuel infrastructure and new cleaner fuel infrastructure. This came up in the final stakeholder meeting, and the proposal was, why not split those into two categories and limit new cleaner fuel infrastructure to infrastructure that handles only cleaner fuels? So to unpack that a little more, anything that would handle cleaner fuels is permitted. But if a company, for the purposes of producing cleaner fuels, wants to expand their petroleum infrastructure, petroleum tanks, that would still be limited. So this definition, and the reason newer and expanded are backwards now is because I tried to alphabetize them, although, you know, these days I struggle with the alphabet. So expanded cleaner is going to be limited, as you'll see, and regardless of whether the petroleum tanks are feeding part of a cleaner infrastructure, cleaner fuel production train, they're still limited. Whereas the new is unlimited. Again, all subject to CEPA and the enhanced CEPA procedures. We're defining petroleum, and this will get clear as we get into more of the code. I'm just walking you through the definitions. Petroleum, crude oil, petroleum products, byproducts, gaseous hydrocarbons, and byproducts. So fossil fuel was not a sufficiently specific term. So we looked at some definitions and came up with this, and it captures everything from crude oil to bunker fuel to LNG and natural gas. And then finally, storage capacity, we want it to be very clear, that's gallons. So it is when we say storage capacity, and we no longer just generically say capacity, it's storage capacity. This is gallons. So stepping into the code, the draft code on this, so this is new and expanded. Here we reference the enhanced CEPA checklist. And so the first subheader is a limitation, prohibition on repurposing. If we've permitted either new or expanded cleaner fuel infrastructure, that's all it can be used for, cannot be repurposed for traditional petroleum. If we have allowed, and then if we do allow expansion of former or predominantly or entirely petroleum infrastructure for purposes of producing cleaner fuels, that cannot be more than 15%. And the 15% is cumulative. So this is a total increase of 15% more storage, gallons over the applicant's total petroleum storage on the effective date of the chapter. So as we work through this, you'll see it is a top number of 15%. So any other allowances for expansion in this are combined. So if it ends up being 10% for cleaner fuels, then there's 5% left for anything else. So the second motion is limited petroleum fuel facility expansion permitted. And I apologize. I should have put into this that it was more than storage. This was intended to be storage, transloading, transshipment. So it should be considered in that light. And I didn't put that additional language in. I missed that today. So this is a petroleum expansion, and it would be within that collective 15% cap, but it would allow petroleum tankage, transloading, transshipment, storage, production, an increase within the overall a collective 15% cap. It wouldn't have to be tied to renewables or any other category. And there's a few more in this. So the third motion, and I know you're all familiar with these because we've talked about it in multiple meetings, and I'll get through it as quick as I can. This is the petroleum fuel projects for maintenance, safety, security, or required to meet regulatory changes. And so this is not significantly different from what you've seen before. It would allow petroleum facilities, and that would include not just tankage, but transloading, transshipment, production, to be improved. And as you'll see from the code, if any of that improvement, repair, entails an increase in capacity, that increase goes into, again, the 15% cumulative cap. So it may be that any of those activities can be accomplished without increasing storage capacity, but if it does, it goes into the 15% cap. Motion four. So this is the national security, and I mentioned I had the opportunity to talk to Congressman Smith's office about this, and they put me in touch with a congressional staffer that works with defense, Department of Defense. And I was able to understand from her that defense had been alerted to this issue and was paying attention to it. What they really wanted and needed was an exemption along the lines of what the state of Washington provided with the Clean Fuel Standard by exempting aviation fuel. And so this this definition has been worked through quite a bit. And it is it would allow that exemption where there is a specific written request by the Department of Defense. In the definition, in the draft code, we've included in the definition any subdivision of the Department of Defense, including the Defense Logistics Agency, as the most likely agency to be making that request. And then motion five is the maritime vessels and petroleum fuel facilities. As with the last time, we stuck with the MARPOL definition. The port had proposed some language that kind of changed the reference to the U.S. statute which adopted MARPOL. And if you follow that, if you eventually get back to MARPOL Annex 6, so for purposes of ease of permitting and not forcing the permit technicians to search for things, we stuck with MARPOL in this. This expansion is still subject to the 15% cumulative cap. And in the draft code, there is an added requirement that the committee hasn't seen before. Where the project is requested in writing by a marine bunkering company or ocean carrier serving Puget Sound. This was language suggested by the port. We felt it offered some, you know, good clarification. Still subject to the 15% cumulative cap and still subject to the no repurposing clauses. And finally, this is the motion and draft code relating to the one project which has had its full build out studied. This is the PSD second production train, been studied, submitted plans. The plans have been fully reviewed. The EIS has been done for that train, for that second train, it's in there. And we have entered into a written mitigation agreement with PSE to mitigate the project, including the second train. And that has been fully funded already by PSE. So this is avoidance of a question of vesting. Critics of this language will say that there is not a specific case which extends vesting to this scenario. And that's true. However, the principles that are applied in Washington vesting cases, which is one of my subjects of great study over my career, if applied to this situation, are almost certainly going to determine that this is vested. So what this language does is it avoids the fight, which I think is, from as the perspective of the person who would probably have to defend it, I think this is appropriate. So with that, I would be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Steve. So oh my goodness, this computer. Okay, I can't get my video off. Bear with me. There it is. Thank you, Steve. Before we do questions, can you just, because I think it's really important to the conversation, can you, two things, can you kind of compare what is before us now to what Whatcom County just passed? Because I know I've received a lot of emails saying, Whatcom County did it, you can do it, City of Tacoma. So how are we the same and how are we different? And then the second question I would have is just reviewing the clean fuel standard exemptions, because my reading of the clean fuel standard exemptions that is lauded as, you know, a huge step forward statewide for, you know, reducing greenhouse gas emissions and addressing climate change. My understanding of the CFS is that it exempts some of the things we're already talking about, marine fuels, fueling of military vehicles, aviation fuels. So some of the things we're debating or discussing are already exempt from the state CFS purview. So Whatcom County and CFS, I think that gets common.
So, Chair, I'll take those in reverse order, because the exemptions are very straightforward. So the state clean fuel standard exempts marine fuels completely. It exempts aviation fuels completely. And it exempts military fuels completely. So as much as we have in these proposals, which require some evidence, we're going a little further than the state of Washington has gone. And because we've put some limits on these expansions, we're again going a little further than the state of Washington. On those same topics, I do not see anything on those topics in the Whatcom rules. So they're kind of the opposites in the sense that I didn't see any marine fuel allowances in Whatcom. Now, that may be because they're not a significant container port. It may not be an issue, but their regulations are aimed primarily at their being an export terminal and at specific environmental risks that exist in their area. So they're quite different in that respect. What our similarities are with Whatcom is, I'm going to scroll up without hopefully nauseating anybody. Their definition of what fuels are allowed is substantially identical to ours. They didn't tie it expressly to the different state statutes, but the same things are in it. A difference, though, is that Whatcom works almost everything through a conditional use permit. We are proposing to achieve the same results through an enhanced SEPA process. Whatcom does have, as I mentioned in the beginning, a GHG gas analysis, requires a GHG gas analysis as part of the CUP. And then Whatcom does have some significant regulations on transloading, transshipment, transportation that are grounded in local hazard analysis. So those are the differences. And the GHG analysis and the hazard analysis are things that, as I mentioned at the beginning, I recommend taking up in the sub-area plan. I do think those are consultant work. So those are the main differences as I know them. And of course, I always invite my learned colleague, Mr. Huffman, to weigh in if he wishes, but that's what I know.
Thank you, Steve. Okay, let's questions, comments. You get as many bites at the apple as you want. We got time. Councilmember Beal.
Yeah, thank you. All right, so I know a lot of you guys have seen a lot of this. I saw this maybe 5 minutes before the meeting because I was at work. So bear with me a little bit here, Steve. I have some just overarching questions. I guess the first one is the genesis of some of these amendments were political, council-led. Are these now staff's recommendations, or is this an amalgamation of council requests and staff refinements?
Don't give me any easy questions, council member.
Fair enough.
I think at this point, from my perspective, I do think that some of these are staff and some of them are still, I think, legislative in origin. If you want me to parse it a little further, I will. The definition of cleaner fuels and cleaner fuel infrastructure, Peter and I both believe that is a very good definition, absent the opportunity and the code associated with that. Absent the opportunity to do a much deeper dive, which we can have in the sub-area plan, we think these are clear. We think they're reviewable. So number one, I, and unless Peter has any other comments, number one for me is a recommendation, that both the motion and the code.
Oh, Steve, you muted yourself.
I did. I muted myself. That was subliminal. That was some sort of Freudian slip. The 15% cumulative cap, the enhanced SEPA, we're very invested in that. We think that is good. Motion three, we also think that's good and necessary, because without something that says you can do these repairs, you can do these upgrades for these reasons. And if it happens that there just isn't a tank or something, you know, the replacement tanks are, you know, 7% bigger or 5% bigger, it's all here. Someone who's reviewing these permits can know, yeah, that's okay. It gets added to this applicant's cumulative total, but we support that. And then I personally, as an attorney, support motion 6. The rest of them, I think, while we like the drafting, are policy decisions. They're political policy. I mean, they all are. But the more, I guess, the more technical ones we support.
Steve, are you guys going to write up a supplement to the findings of fact that provides analysis on consistency with the amendments and the findings of fact, given that we're not changing them?
So, council member, that is an excellent question. My recommendation is that the council hold a public hearing. And on the basis of the public hearing, the full council can, and I believe should, add its own findings. So, you know, the Planning Commission is a recommending body. There was discussion at the beginning of this endeavor at IPS that we thought the findings were, not we, you, thought the findings were adequate. But I think that it is important for the council to hold at least one public hearing on these proposed amendments or those that are ultimately voted through by IPS. And then add some findings for whatever ultimately, if there is ultimately an adoption for the council to add its own findings.
So where does the 15%, how are you guys going to analyze that for us and provide us legislative? Like the big red line in the sand for me has always been expansion of existing petroleum or fossil fuel projects. And it's baked into almost all of these amendments. How is staff going to reconcile the fact the findings of fact don't, Planning Commission findings of fact, which are going to remain as part of the record.
They will.
I understand it with some kind of supplementation, which is fine, which is appropriate. How are we reconciling that expansion?
So what we can provide is an analysis of what 15% means and an analysis of whether that's within, so first, what does it mean? And second, how is it consistent with the comp plan?
Is that going to be a revised SEPA checklist for the code amendments, or have you guys already processed?
I think we should do a revised SEPA checklist. Absolutely.
Okay.
It's a great question.
Yeah, there's a lot of environmental analysis here that
there is.
I don't know how you stand. I mean, honestly, it feels like we need to reconcile some of those things if that's going to move forward.
I agree.
I'm just not convinced necessarily. And I know that there's, I feel like there were all these mediation meetings and I, as just a normal committee member, wasn't necessarily involved in those. So I take sort of this narrow view of what we've talked about at these IPS meetings. We've had good panel discussions. We've talked about the amendments. This is the first time I'm seeing the code draft, and I'm just shocked at how many times the percentage expansion is baked in here. And it's hard for me to track it as a legislative policymaker. I feel like the planners internal at the city are going to have a hard time tracking individual facilities and how often we're being asked to entertain the 15% expansion, particularly when we don't really have a documentable track record with a land use permit, like a conditional use permit, which I guess dovetails into my next question is, I know we talked about it. I just don't remember. And is this a staff recommendation that we're not going to use land use permitting at all, and we're going to use this expanded SEPA process in lieu of? Is that staff's recommendation across the board? Or I just don't remember the committee concluding that.
I don't think we're saying we're not going to use land use permitting. I would ask Peter to, if he can jump in and address that, because that is, I think it'd be helpful if Peter could talk to that.
Well, I think what we're saying is that it will be permitted outside of a conditional use permit, and that the issues that the conditional use permit were seen as a venue to address will be addressed through the expanded SEPA. So when I say whether, I'm not quite following you. I mean, obviously there will be an application. The project will be reviewed against all, you know, all other standards. I mean, for example, landscaping and right-of-way standards and, you know, environmental standards from stormwater, et cetera. But from a land use permitting, there won't be a CUP, there'll be the enhanced SEPA.
Well, the one question I have I have a few questions about the enhanced SEPA. One of which is, I'm a little bit worried that the enhanced SEPA process is somehow going to lessen or weaken the argument that an EIS should be prepared for some of these projects. And one of the reasons why is that it mirror images so much of like the expanded scoping process that's standard for an EIS. Does staff believe that this would in any way supplant or offset a DS for a project if it was large enough? Or do you guys just not anticipate us ever DSing another project under this code?
Well, that's hard to say, but I think the conversations that we've had is we think that the enhanced SEPA and any supplemental checklist that is developed pursuant to the subarea plan will probably increase the likelihood, depending on the scope of the project, of an EIS. So I think what it's going to do is it's going to provide us more information. And, you know, again, depending on the information that's provided in the project and what we, I mean, it's going to, you know, that's hard to say other than the fact that it will provide us more information to make our decision on that threshold determination.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think from my perspective, I think it's more likely to cause us to require a DS, to issue a DS and require an EIS, because we'll have more information about the potential impacts and be in a much more defensible position to say, yeah, we don't know enough. We don't know how to mitigate these. So we really do have to have an EIS.
I agree.
But council member, you know, you work in this area too. So absolutely. We don't know what the consequences will be. It's a little bit new territory.
Are you guys worried at all about participation fatigue in terms of because the way I'm reading the motion and the code, it requires essentially an expanded scoping process. And I'm sorry to my committee members, I'm in total full planner nerd mode here, but it requires essentially the same outreach process that you're going to then repeat. Like if you do this process in the upfront and then you determine it's a significant project, you're going to go into an EIS and do the same thing again. I get a little bit worried as a practitioner when we repeat land use processes multiple times and ask the public to participate when they didn't really understand what the first round was and what the difference is in the second round. And again, I can't continue to go back to wanting to make sure that we have an authentic way for people to understand, really sensitive, and not even just sensitive, world changing, because the world is changing because of climate change. We're talking about projects that are contributing that in our community, in our front yard, on a tribal reservation, in an area that has a lot of sensitive environmental and critical areas. And people want to be involved in these processes. I just get a little bit worried, we do this enhanced SEPA, which is essentially sort of a neighborhood meeting, invite the public to participate in the upfront review. And then the agency, let's say, issues a DS, we're going to do the same thing again. And I just worry about the public not understanding or being generally confused. Wait, I thought I already went to that meeting. Why would I care? And then all of a sudden they're not a party of record on a DS. and aren't able to appeal it, aren't really understanding what's going on, thought they participated already when they didn't. You see where I'm going with that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I would say, Councilmember, I don't share that concern. I might share that concern if we had a conditional use permit in there as well, because then I think it gets confusing because now people are participating in two different sort of permitting processes. But what we have found out with the SEPA meetings that we're having citywide and just sort of that pre-SEPA meeting, having a discussion about how SEPA works, that is very informative and educational to people so that they understand, you know, what they're commenting on, how they're commenting, when they're commenting on, and the process moving forward. So I would think what this does is this gives people more understanding of the SEPA process and keeps them engaged through the entire process, and then puts them in our records so that they continue to get notified as the SEPA process progresses.
Okay. Steve, in the first part of the motion one, if you could scroll up just to the top of motion one, I wanted to ask a quick question because we define this enhanced SEPA review under the motion, and maybe this is just an oversight or a vestige of how it was written before, but it says I move to allow blah, 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 including SEPA review. Did you mean enhanced SEPA review or just?
I did. I mean, Councilmember, absolutely. And everywhere where it says that, it means the enhanced SEPA review.
Okay.
And I may have added enhanced SEPA review in some of these. And then again, I may have.
Yeah, I saw it as enhanced towards the bottom of it. I just.
You're absolutely right. It should be
enhanced. I'll make sure it's clean. Okay. So on the motion one, and I'm sorry, I'm trying to go through these quick, but I just have a bunch of questions.
Yeah.
Under motion one on A, you said that the credit generating fuel designation would occur at the time of application. Now, when we got the presentation from Craig Kenworthy at Clean Air, we're able to look at the life of the program till 2035 and know what the credit generating ratio is. Couldn't this just say any credit generating fuel for the life of CFS or projected credit generating to 2035? Or is there some issue with vesting there that I'm not understanding?
So initially, I didn't walk away, and this may be my error, with an understanding that we would be able to tell that from day one.
Well, he displayed a graph, and I remember the graph because we developed it on Clean Air when we were doing it. And it gives you like a target number, and then the applicant can show like this type of fuel has a credit generating ratio of whatever it was, 72, not 92. Because as he said, like one of the questions that was asked was, is E85 credit generating? And he said, well, yeah, it is at the beginning of the program. But what we know about the target and the way that we set it up in Clean Air that didn't get passed because of the Supreme Court decision that then kicked it to state legislature was, we knew at the outset that E85 was credit generating in the first, I remember, 2 or 3 years, but in the subsequent years, E85 was deficit generating. And I guess my interest is making sure that if we're allowing some kind of fuel, that it's credit generating based on the projection of the end of the life of the program in 2035, which I think is what you've said. That seems easy to be able to verify an applicant provide that information at the time. It feels like we may be loopholing in fuels that within a year or two could be deficit generating and undercut the intent of that portion of the amendment.
So to directly answer your question, if it is going to be possible to determine that from, you know, day one to day, however many days is 2035, we could do that. We could put an additional modifier on it. That would, in my view, need to be analyzed to figure out what the effect of that would be. And then I would probably say that needs to be done in the sub-area plan.
Well, the effect would be that we would be permitting things that we reliably and predictably could know are going to be clean fuels through the life of the CFS and not permitting dirty fuels after they were clean fuels at one point in the program when we knew that they would change to something different. And I guess it dovetails into my question about subsection D. So this thing is, the way it's written, I mean, we just talked about E85. the way it's written is like, does E10 apply to this? Meaning somebody could come in with an E10 blend, which is basically normal fuel now, and be permitted under this? Because it says ethanol blends, meeting Washington state requirements.
Yeah, under the Washington state requirements, and I'm not nearly enough of an expert on fuels, but the state statute lists its requirements. And my understanding is that from reading the statutes is that the state does not require a particular proportion of blend to be within the scope of the state ethanol statute. So that's a long yes. I think the scenario that you're talking about is possible, but I don't know enough about the blends themselves.
I gotta say, that's just kind of mind-blowing, Steve, because it's essentially this big loophole. And the reason why I say that is, like, if I'm just reading this, that first line, the way the paragraph is written out, it says, like, if you could scroll up just a little bit, I'm sorry. You know, it says that are carbon free and generate no carbon emissions and fuels that are blah, 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 including subsection D, regular fuel with two droplets of soybean oil meet the requirement. And I'm just really struggling with that because basically any fuel that you can buy now, in fact, I think all the fuels you buy now are E5, E10 blends. It just seems like all of these things, and then they're sort of like this big Trojan horse built into subsection D that allows for E10 blends, which is just normal fuel.
And Councilmember, the only thing I would say is we incorporated the state, you know, I incorporated the state standard that's in the state statute. And if we are to do something else, the question would be, what standard do we require and how do we arrive at it?
Well, I guess I would say you could strike D and just go with credit generating fuel under CFS through 2035 and have nothing around D. I mean, because it deals then with the ethanol blended fuels. If it's an ethanol blended fuel that is credit generating in 2035, it'd be allowed. If it wasn't, it wouldn't be allowed. I mean, I guess that's what I would prefer. But that's, you know, that's, again, probably less of a question for you. I'm just going to you on the portion of the amendment. The last section, I'm really sorry, Steve. I'm just...
No. This is good.
Under subsection E, we reference this California Motor Vehicle Emission Standards, but I feel like in the code below, that portion is missing. I don't know if you want to scroll down.
Yeah, I substituted... So the actual state statute is basically the verbatim, the language of E, and it is called the Alternative Fuel Statute. So it incorporates a specific California Motor Vehicle Emission Standard in the state statute. And so I used the Alternative Fuels title as a reference to that statute, but I have no issue with clarifying that.
So if it was like a natural gas or propane product, we're talking about like, what is it, CNG that our transit buses use. Is that the type of fuel we're talking about that would qualify?
Absolutely. That's correct.
And what type of, I mean, people are automatically going to jump to the conclusion that this is going to allow like another LNG plant. Is this related to LNG? I mean, can you use LNG for motor vehicle fuels?
If only I were a fuels engineer, but I don't know that the answer to that question. I am not, you know, aware of LNG being used in motor vehicles. CNG certainly, but I'm not aware of LNG. If there were, and this is specific to motor vehicles, so if there were an LNG product that was used in motor vehicles and it met the California emission standards that are incorporated into the Washington state statute, then yes.
Okay.
But if it didn't do all those things, then no.
Okay. On motion number three, Steve, could you just scroll down a little bit?
Yeah, you bet.
On motion number three, I guess I'm confused by the title of the motion. Maybe this is a vestige of a council written motion, but this allows for replacement that allows expansion of petroleum storage. Because all it says in the title is maintenance, safety, security requirements to meet regulatory changes. It feels a little, feels like maybe if this was something that was in a voter pamphlet, it wouldn't say that. Like, it almost feels like it needs to have some kind of independent, because if it is truly for safety, security, maintenance, that type of thing, I guess I'm almost like, why would you need it? But then I read it and it's like, well, it does allow for petroleum storage expansions of 15% of volume, which is huge. For some facilities, that's really big.
So Councilmember, the 15% was a matter of constant debate and back and forth. There is a version of this that does not have that 15% clause at all. And you would read it to say that if the improvement, replacement, regulatory compliance increase the capacity by even a gallon, that it would be prohibited. And so this, the 15% came back in because of the scenario that was contemplated where we're replacing rusty tanks and there are not, or whatever happens to the tanks in fuel production, there are not, you know, exactly the same capacity tanks to replace them. They're 1% bigger or 2% bigger. The permitting person didn't have to say, well, that's prohibited. And so 15%, because it's cumulative, was added back in just to allow for that particular scenario. And so this would contribute to the 15% theoretically, but not be any addition to the cap. It's cumulative.
So one question I guess I have on this type of language about maintenance, replacement, rusty tanks, blah, blah, blah. Are petroleum facilities non-conforming under this code?
They are not. Nor are they under Whatcom. They're conforming uses. They remain in Whatcom code permitted uses, and they would here as well. So they're not non-conforming uses. So a fair question from someone who works in this business would be, why do we need this, Mr. Victor? Because they're permitted uses. They can repair. I mean, it's not like they're non-conforming uses. And that's a fair question, Councilmember.
Is that a change from the Planning Commission's recommendation?
No, the Planning Commission maintained them as permitted uses, but made everything, including this type of work, subject to a conditional use permit, which Peter and I thought, and as we discussed in an earlier meeting, was kind of a strange fit. You have a permitted use that's surrounded by other permitted uses doing the same thing, but it's a conditional use permit if you're just going to repair or replace something. So that's the genesis of this amendment. And the if we did not have this amendment and they remain permitted uses, could they do these things under the standard permitting process? I think so. I mean, I asked, Peter has more expertise than I do. And if he has different thoughts on it, I'd invite him to participate.
I concur.
Okay. What's MARPOL? I don't know what MARPOL is.
So MARPOL is a treaty. And I can't remember the full name of it, but since I wrote it out, it's the International Convention for the Prevention of Pollution from Ships. That's the name of the treaty. And it is adopted by an act of Congress, ratified, I should say, by an act of Congress. And in the United States, it is regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency, is the agency regulator. And it prescribes a number of measures that are in effect with all the treaty nations to do what it says, prevent pollution from ships. And it, Annex 6 specifies fuels. So all of the ships that we see are operating in accordance with that. At this point, clearly it allows bunker fuel. My understanding is that there is a plan to go through and increase or improve the greenhouse gas emissions and improve the fuels used by ships. But like any international convention that's worked through the UN, it takes a long time.
The other question I have about, and I'm sorry I jumped the gun on that MARPOL one, I wrote it down in sequence, but I was reading through, and I think you mentioned this from Motion 6, about the dates, and this Motion 6 is kind of a weird one to me because it's, you know, it was during a different point in time where, you know, I was sponsoring an amendment to freeze expansion of fossil fuels. And there was a portion of that you and I had talked about. We included it. This is sort of a pulled apart version of that that has different dates in it and references to code and state law. It seems like things have changed a little bit. So this one's a little bit weird to me. I read through and I think you mentioned critics of some of these portions of this amendment would say the Earth Justice letter, which was obviously written by legal counsel. You know, there's a couple things built in there. And the reason why I ask that question about nonconforming, why do you think Earth Justice believes the Planning Commission recommendation made fossil fuel facilities nonconforming? Where would they have drawn that conclusion from?
I don't know, Councilor. I mean, honestly, I don't think it makes them nonconforming. I've never read it to do that. And I'd invite Peter to chime in, but I don't think it does. It certainly doesn't do it expressly. Peter?
Well, I would ask you to repeat that question again.
Well, I'm looking at their report, and they said the Planning Commission's recommendations effectively make fossil fuels use non-conforming citywide because it proposes a ban on new facilities and prohibits expansion of existing facilities. But we're now going the other direction, not requiring conditional use permits and allowing expansion under certain scenarios. So just fundamentally seems like, and maybe this isn't related to six anymore, but just the broader thing of like, if other legal counsel who deals with environmental law probably way more than we do believes that the Planning Commission recommendation made fossil fuel facilities non-conforming because they prohibited them, and now we're allowing expansions, including expansion of just traditional E10 fuels as sort of a Trojan horse Section D under a section that's called cleaner fuels, man, I'm just really struggling with a lot of this. And I'm sorry you guys are on this roller coaster ride with me for 20 minutes here, but I'm just struggling with a lot of what's going on with these amendments.
So Councilor, let me take that a little bit first. I think what the letter is saying is that even though the Planning Commission, like Whatcom, did not expressly say they become non-conforming uses. In fact, Whatcom specifically says they remain permitted uses. They're arguing, as advocates do, that the effect is that they are become treated as non-conforming uses. And I think that there's a fair argument there, but the preservation on new petroleum facilities remains. That remains under any scenario. There are no new pure petroleum facilities permitted under any of these amendments. I think the argument that by removing the conditional use permit, then we are now allowing them. But as we discussed, I believe it was the last meeting, could have been the meeting before that. Peter and I don't agree that there's a meaningful difference between SEPA and a conditional use permit in this context. So I also wouldn't agree that the attorneys for Earth Justice deal with land use more than I do. I don't think anybody deals with land use more than I do, except possibly a couple other attorneys I know in practice. So so that's just a plug for me. So I think they're saying the net effect is that they're treated under the Planning Commission recommendation as not conforming, although they are not expressly labeled as non-conforming.
Okay.
Well, I love the Trojan horse reference, but yeah. I want to talk about the Iliad, but this is not the time and place.
Sorry, I'm gonna end there, Chair. I've taken way too much of the time here. I do appreciate you guys indulging me and answering all the questions. Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Thank you, Councilmember Beal. Councilmember Hunter.
Thank you, Chair, and I appreciate Councilmember Beal's expertise here because he knows to ask questions that I wouldn't think of. But one thing I did really note in those comments was I believe you used the term process fatigue, and when we look at what we're doing here with the non-interim regulations. I was also at the sub-area plan steering committee meeting last week. As you know, I serve on that committee as well. And I think there is an element of process fatigue around this because we are going to be doing all of this again in short order. And while that does sound like a complaint, maybe it is. I think it's also important to know that there is going to be another go round on this, should we not have it perfect this time. So I think we can go for a very long time, and there's always going to be something which someone is going to take issue with here. It's not going to be perfect. It's just not the nature of the beast because we have such a widespread continuum of thought on this. But I do appreciate what staff has done here. And thank you, Mr. Victor, for your presentation, moving it forward, and also Mr. Huffman for his input there. We have had a unique opportunity over the past 4 or 5 meetings, how many times we've been meeting about this, to hear from stakeholders that we have not heard from before and get some different perspectives. And I think that this, one of the benefits here is that this has really been a great learning, clarification experience for this committee that doesn't have the benefit of a planning background. I don't really have a question, but I think we need to, I'm always fond of looking at where other municipalities have created policy, and the Whatcom policy has come up, or excuse me, the policies for the Whatcom port has come up. And I think it's a good guide for us, but I think we also have to keep in mind that Whatcom is different from Tacoma. They are not the same creatures. You know, we are the gateway to the Pacific. We move cargo out of our port, and we have part of an economic engine that affects not only this state and beyond, but out into international waters. We do not export, I don't believe, fuel at the level that Whatcom does. They have BP is up there, one of the Goliaths of the fossil fuel industry. So while I think we can learn something from the Whatcom port policies, we need to keep it in mind that our Tacoma port is a unique creature and has different attributes and different purposes and different businesses. And I think that I want to put that at the forefront, that we are mostly a container port and not a exporting fossil fuels across the world as is happening out of Whatcom. So, again, just an appreciation to staff here. And I also do appreciate Councilmember Beal's clarifying questions. And I think we have, it's going to take some time to digest this, get some input, but I think we have done good work and made great progress to come up with motions that we can move to full council consideration. So that's it on that for the moment. So again, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, staff.
Thank you, Councilmember Hunter. Vice Chair Walker. Vice Chair Walker, should we take down, do you want us to take down the Word document, or do you want to go through it with, it's the, up to you.
Oh, yeah, you can take it down. I don't think we need it.
Cool.
So thank you, Steve and Peter, for putting these forward, and thank you to the entire committee for pushing these forward till the votes till Monday. I think there's still just a few too many things at the short notice. So I do want to say before I ask my questions that I am supportive of bringing forward that insurance amendment, just to see if we can get that sorted out, whether it's before Monday or before it comes to full council, but to get that part of the discussion. I'd love to see that. Steve, I thought that in the renewables definition that we had written green hydrogen in there rather than just hydrogen, because I know there are some types of hydrogen that are not. Is that, did we switch that intentionally, or is that an oversight, and can we get it back in there?
we certainly can. That was an oversight. I wasn't clear from the Tacoma Public Utilities representatives what their perspective on that was. But I can put it in and we will find out.
that would be great. And I will check in with them for sure. But my understanding is that pretty broad support across the board that we want to go for green hydrogen in Tacoma.
Great.
My next question, I think, is actually a question for you, Councilmember Beal. You had said at some point that you were concerned that the CEPA review might go to a different entity rather than Tacoma. So even if we do all these enhanced pieces, that it wouldn't necessarily be under our purview. Was that addressed? And if not, where would that go?
Well, and that was part of my question, I think, Steve, from the last meeting, is how do we assure that we are the lead agency for any of these proposals under this code? I don't know that that's necessarily been answered. That's a good question. I don't know, Steve, is that something you guys can do?
I don't think it's been answered. So can we put that in? Yes, we can. I think we are by default the lead agency for anything that happens in our jurisdiction. And historically, we have had to agree to not be lead agency, but we can expressly state that in these regulations. We absolutely can add that.
I think that would be good, because I think, and I'm sorry, Councilmember Walker.
Go ahead. That's why I asked you.
Just a follow up from before, like, I'm just thinking through, we put this really well-intentioned code in with the intent, I think, I will give credit where credit's due here. You guys, I think, did a good job at earnestly looking at the process and trying to replicate a way for the public to be informed and involved in a proposal, if we're not going to go down a conditional use permit path, at least honoring and respecting the fact that people need to be involved and informed about the permitting decisions. No question there. It definitely would do that. I just would get concerned with, like, we've just heard a lot of advocacy on behalf of, say, like the port, and I think the port can be a lead agency. And I just don't want there to be any kind of conflicts over, well, that's city code, about city being a lead agency. We're the lead agency and we have our own CEPA procedures. We're not going to follow that. And then you guys having to get in a fight with them or something like that. So
I'll take that fight all day long, Councilmember.
Yeah, I think that's a good clarification. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah.
Great. And then there was one, I just wanted to clarify, because this is brand new language, I think. In the definitions on the first motion, I guess it's in the code. Can you just say, because I think that I understood what you're saying. Under the code, under the new and expanded cleaner fuel infrastructure, the difference between one and two, and why two has a percentage and one doesn't? Because I'm thrown off because number one says any new or expanded, and then number two says any expanded. So I just think I don't understand the language quite yet.
So the difference is that only new infrastructure that handles the cleaner parts of cleaner fuels is allowed. That's the only thing that can be new. So the any expansion of, so there's no new petroleum infrastructure allowed for pure petroleum. Petroleum can only be expanded from existing infrastructure. And that's why by no more than 15% cumulative with any, you know, in combination with any other allowances. And that is subject to the 15%. So in the original version of this, we were talking about if a new tank for nothing but petroleum was needed as part of a clean fuel production train, that would be allowed. Now we've dialed that back and said that is not allowed. It is, you can only use your existing petroleum tanks or expand them by up to 15% for the production of cleaner fuels, but you cannot build new petroleum storage tanks, if that makes sense.
Okay, that does make sense. My follow-up question, I guess, then, is for Peter on how we track whether or not a new petroleum storage is intended for renewables or cleaner fuels. Does your staff have the capacity to do that?
Yeah, I mean, all of this approach has been run through my staff. I believe I understand your question, and yeah, I think we can do what's been outlined here.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, because we're assuming that the applicant is providing us, you know, the information and abiding by the information that they're providing us. Yes, we can do what's outlined here.
I had a good discussion with Shirley Schultz about applying these. And she said, I understand them. I can apply them. It looks like a lot of work for me. So I don't like it from that perspective. But we will need the applicant to show us, to demonstrate for us what this production train looks like, what tanks do much, how much they hold. And if we don't have that, we'll keep asking for it, or they won't get a permit and they won't get a review. This is all, and I absolutely agree with Councilmember Beal. The keeping track of the 15% cumulative is difficult. That's a complex task, but we have to figure out a way to do it if this goes forward in this form.
Yeah, so I think, Councilmember, what you'll see is what we call tip sheets developed, that as this progresses, the tip sheets will be specific to the applicant what information, technical information, we require of them to be able to make this determination. And so it's going to be a learning curve on our behalf to find out specific information and what they can provide us. And as Steve just said, we might find out that as we progress of this, the applicant may need to do more, they might need to do studies or find technical data that is not usually part of their normal process that we need to make the determination. But those are going to evolve as this happens to make Shirley's life a little bit easier.
So those were my questions. I just had one comment on the third one. I have been very supportive of this throughout. I think it feels like it's, and based some on my colleagues' questions, it feels like it has has shifted a little bit in that the original intention had been the expansions of petroleum storage are allowed as long as they're in service to a transition to renewables. And now that we've put the 15% in, now we do have a space where you could just build a 15% bigger tank or a 15% bigger without any sort of, I keep using this term, in service to moving towards renewables or clean fuels. So I'm wondering if there is just a little language that we could put in there, because I really am supportive of that. And you know, we had a lot of discussion with the industry about, you know, we may need to do something that would inadvertently, like you said, Steve, you know, they build large, or, you know, they make larger tanks at this point, and we do want to improve on a rusty tank or something like that. And so I'm sensitive to that. I don't want it to be zero, but I'm also worried that what we did inadvertently as we built this thing is created a bit of a loophole. So just something maybe we can talk about offline, because I am really supportive of that concept, but I feel like we've gone off a little bit. So that's all I have for now. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Walker. So I guess one of the questions I have, I do think we should, so when I look up what at least I can find on Ecology's website in terms of whether or not the tables that establish what a credit generating fuel will be in 2035, I don't know that it's there. I remember Craig Kenworthy said there are some resources, but I believe that's part of the rulemaking process. So when I read what the rulemaking process will be at the state level for determining what is a credit generating fuel, that they will, it says announce the rule July 21, propose the rule summer of next year, and then adopt it the winter of next year. And I don't see, and when I look at what will the rule do, it will establish the carbon intensity standards for transportation fuels, assign compliance obligations to fuels with carbon intensities that exceed the standard. And it's, so that whole table of what's credit generating, what will be credit generating in 2035, I don't think it's there today.
So that
I don't want to know. Yeah.
Chair, I looked at my notes, and my notes are not infallible. But what I got was that the graph that Craig Kenworthy showed us was a proposal that they'd made, but was not an official graph. So I don't know that we know for certain today whether we will, at the end of the implementation of the Clean Fuel Standard, be able to know what will be credit generating at the end from day one. That was a proposal. And some of the other things he was showing us were proposals that they made. But he doesn't know what Ecology will come out with at the end. At least that's what my notes say.
Yeah, and I think that's true, but I think we should confirm before we vote Monday, if possible. I think a couple thoughts. One is we did have a discussion in some of the breakout meetings about adding a percentage to, I'm talking about blends, what blends are allowed, what blends are not allowed. And so this percentage of, well, you can only, it's only clean if you're, it's more than 50% renewable. And some of the pushback there was, well, there's no actual market for that product or very little right now. So what you're effectively doing when you put that requirement in to say you can only build projects that, you know, let's say have more than 50% of the renewable part of the blend, that what you're effectively doing is saying, you know, there won't be any project built. So, for me, it's always don't make the perfect the enemy of the good. And the fact that, you know, we're talking about incremental infrastructure improvements that will actually work in the real world and have the intended effect, which is reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So this renewable might not be the best renewable today, but it's better than the alternative in terms of impacts on greenhouse gas emissions. And that when we effectively prohibit those types of projects, what I'm told on and what I understand is what we're really doing is just actually driving up emissions because the fuel demand's there and the fuel just gets bunkered, just gets barged in or trucked in with greater environmental impacts to everybody. But I do totally acknowledge, you know, what my colleague said in terms of talking about the, you know, longstanding impacts of infrastructure projects. And I know that I'm just saying that's something we wrestled with in those breakout committee meetings. There was no consensus between the two sides, if you will. But I don't think it's fair to characterize it as a Trojan horse. If Whatcom County is the standard today and those types of blends are allowed in Whatcom County. So that's what I would want. Also, another question, I'd want to confirm that, whether that's true or not. But that's the only really questions I have. I mean, regardless of where we end up Monday, I think the beauty of what this committee will accomplish is we're going to, you know, in turning the non-interim rules into non-interim rules, which non-interim is just kind of a funny concept. Is it permanent? No, it's just non-interim. Well, how long does it last? Well, it'll last until the subarea plan is adopted. And I have new hope now today that my friend Steve Victor said it will be adopted in 2022.
That's just me.
First time in 4 years anyone's put a date on it. And I'm going to write that in my diary tonight, Steve Victor said. But
you know, you can just never unsay things, but that's been a problem for me forever.
But I mean, the beauty of it in all seriousness is that we're going to move from interim rules to non-interim rules that do several things that make it non-interim/permanent, the prohibition on new fossil fuel facilities. And that's a big step forward for this community. And in addition to that, while today the expansion of fossil fuel facilities is unlimited and has been for 4 years in our code, when the council's done with its work, there will be limits on the expansion. And I think that's my 6 years here. I would say that's a huge step forward from a policymaking level in Tacoma. And in addition to that, we'll have, and this is where I say kudos to those who brought this forward, that, you know, now, right now with the interim rules, these types of renewable or clean fuel projects aren't allowed, and they specifically will be allowed when the council, I believe, when the council finishes this work. So at least in my mind, there's three really significant things that will come out of these non-interim rules. And as I said at the outset of the meeting, I think the conversations amongst the stakeholders and getting everybody in the same room is so important because everybody wants the community to be moved forward. And I would submit that we've just been stuck as a community, and getting people in the same room really helps us kind of work through the complexities and nuances of this stuff. And so I think there's good work to be done. And I can't wait until it's the subarea. You know, when the mayor asked whether or not this should go to the committee, I said, you know what? No, why don't you send it to the subarea group? But it came here. And so I'd be happy to see this kick back to the full council for further discussion, for further public comment, public hearing. And then ultimately, after the council adopts whatever it adopts, onto the subarea planning commission that will be complete in 2022. So I see Councilmember Beal's hand up. Yes, sir.
Yeah, thank you. Couple just follow-up things that I heard I wanted to ask Steve and Peter. So the one thing that kind of concerned me, what Peter had mentioned, is the need to track this and the sort of specialization around the fuels. And are we going to have to hire like a on-call person or do additional staff training or hire an additional staff person to help implement the complexity of these codes? Is that what you were saying, Peter?
Not specifically, but I don't, you know, I'm not going to say yes or no. Certainly, like any new code development process, yeah, we'll evaluate, you know, the volume of activity relative to these codes, the complexity of permitting it, from the enhanced SEEP all the way through it, whether or not we need additional staff to meet the expectations that, you know, are set and the need. So I can't say no, but I certainly, you know, I don't know, but that's not unusual for us to hire staff as a result of a new code process.
Okay. Are you guys meeting with any developers of oil projects that are anticipating the adoption of these and trying to get vested?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. I'm aware of non-council member. The one application came in for the replacement of the refinery with tanks. That's undergoing an EIS. We issued a determination of significance. I'm aware of no other applications or discussions for applications.
Is that EIS project vested?
They are fully, they submitted a full, their permit application was complete probably a year ago. So yes, they are vested.
The other couple questions were the additional analysis that's going to go to council. Are we going to see that by Monday, or would that be written based on the way the amendments come out of the committee process vote? The supplemental findings of fact, whatever we're going to call them, Steve.
I don't know the answer to that, council member.
Well, working on them, I assume that means you're waiting till full council.
Yeah,
that's been the process.
That's what I anticipate. Yes.
How would the public be involved in a revised SEPA checklist and seeing that analysis? If somebody was on the call, wanted to know later.
So we would issue a revised SEPA and send out notice and get comments on it. So.
You guys send out like a notice when you have a revised checklist and revised proposal. I don't know what your agency does. I'm just trying to understand how the public might understand the analysis moving forward.
Yeah. If we do a revised checklist, and we will re-notify. I mean, there's also, it'll be go out with the public hearing notification. And so there'll be a we'll reopen it for comment. Per our SEPA guidelines, you know.
Yeah. The last two questions I have, and I'm sorry, I've probably asked 4,000 questions tonight. The additional amendments that the environmental panel had sent you guys, one was the insurance amendment. There were a couple other about SEPA review and the SEPA review process. And then a broader one that I think I need to read through again about requiring reports and a commitment from the existing petroleum companies affected by the regulations and needing to reduce greenhouse gases. Have you guys looked at those? Did you exclude them for a specific reason when they got brought up before? I sent those over to you guys because I was made aware of them kind of late in the process and wasn't sure if we bring those back on Monday to look at them, is the answer going to be, haven't had time to look at them, staff doesn't think we should do anything with them, or did you guys look at them before and just exclude that they're not ready for prime time, or what?
So, Councilmember, if these are the ones that came from Citizens for Healthy Bay, we did absolutely look at them. And in my remarks before going through the motions and draft code, I mentioned some of them. So the insurance, the GHG emission standards, and the regulation of throughput on grounds of safety. And on all of those, I believe that that is sub-area plan work, except maybe the insurance will look at that real hard. I think the other two require sub-area plan consultant work. The final one that you mentioned, we didn't get a chance to discuss it in the meetings. We didn't get to that. I don't fully understand the policy and the details. I did read it. I'm not sure what it does exactly. So that's probably my shortcoming, but I didn't understand it enough. Not that I didn't read it.
Okay. And last question, I promise. On the amendments, is there a way that any committee member can work with you, Steve, or Peter on amendments to the amendments, or are we just voting on these as they're presented? I don't know, maybe that's a chairperson
question. That might be a question for the chair, but council member, you know how notoriously unavailable we are to calls from council members. I'm kidding.
Yeah, I would say absolutely. Councilmember Beal, you can propose whatever you like, including, you know, the things you mentioned that aren't on this list. I would say, though, and you'll get this better than anybody on this call, we just got to be respectful of Peter and Steve's time. So if that's what you want to do, I would work with them sooner rather than later, because I know Steve's got some family stuff this week, and Peter's boat trip got canceled, so he's free the whole weekend, right? I'm just teasing. But yeah, no, whatever you want to propose and bring up, I think that's fine. That's
okay. That's all. I owe you guys all a dinner or a hug or something for indulging me. Thank you.
People in the administration actually think I work on other stuff. So, you know, any way you can disabuse them of that would be, no, I'm kidding.
Okay, I appreciate it. I think that concludes the conversation for tonight. So on Monday, we'll consider these proposals and then any amendments to them that are floated by any committee member and/or additional amendments that any of the committee members want to propose. And we also have residential and chemical. The plan is to have staff shoot that out. Peter, I know you turned off your camera, but I think you said by Friday, right? That's our goal, or?
Yeah, my goal would be to get them out tomorrow with the agenda and the memo supporting information. But if that's not possible, it would come out on Friday before the weekend.
Yeah.
And I wanted to say, Chair and members of the committee, so tomorrow you'll see the amendments that we talked about today and the code we talked about today with the green hydrogen addition, with the SEPA lead agency addition, Chair, with the changes that I forgot to include on motion number 2. And then we will work hard tomorrow to think about the motion number 3 loophole effect. And is there a way to keep the spirit of it without having it appear to be a loophole? So that's my takeaway on those. And then Peter and I and whatever staff we can wrangle, we'll talk about insurance as well to see what information we have on the subject.
And then the residential and chemical will be in the same format as you saw today with the motion and then the associated code with that.
Yeah, I guess that sounds good. Since number 3 came up, and I totally acknowledge what the vice chair said. I mean, in my view, this was about making it clear, right, that repair, replacement, I think improvement got added because there was a question of, again, there's not a whole lot of trust in the room on either side of this issue. So what happens if you say it's not repair? What if it's an improvement, right? But, you know, again, it was linked to safety, security, the facility, meeting regulatory requirements,
meeting the new state clean fuel standard or reduces air emissions or stormwater runoff. So the idea was to, even though those terms replacement, improvement, maintenance seemed kind of broad, we tried to link it back to for what purpose, right? And I think that to Steve's point, the reason the 15% got put back in there, or a percentage, was so that someone couldn't use that as a loophole to build big. This is about, we want to do good things that you would support at the city, like fix a failing pier, but it's going to be bigger, or it's going to be made out of different materials, but it's going to be safer, and come to the permit office and say, I'm sorry, sir, you're operating a fossil fuel facility. You can't do that. And so there was some desire to just clear that up. So I'm not saying I'm not open to any of the changes that, I totally get, like I said, what the vice chair said. So I'm not saying I'm not open to any changes to it. I am, absolutely. But I'm just saying, that I agree that it still has value. And if we can tighten it up so that it works in the real world for its intended purpose and the committee likes it, then I'm good with that. So, all right, let's move on real quick. Topics for upcoming meetings. I'd like to call on Claire Goodwin, committee liaison.
Good evening, Chair and members of the committee. So as you heard, your next meeting is Monday, and we are going to start that at 3:45. It's a special meeting to finalize the recommendations for the tide flats non-interim regulations. And then your next meeting is next week, Wednesday, at 4:30. It's a special meeting. You'll be covering the Planning Commission annual report, looking at the impact fee framework, and a few written reports to the committee from Environmental Services. And then on September 8th, you have Transportation Commission interviews and the first of four meetings addressing the Home in Tacoma project. That's all I've got. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Claire. And any other items of interest? Not seeing any. Public comment. Clerk, will you please read?
Only written comments will be accepted for this meeting. Please submit written comments to ipstideflats@cityoftacoma.org. Comments will be compiled and sent to the committee and posted on the Tide Flats Interim Regulations page at cityoftacoma.org/tideflatsinterim. There have been 41 written comments received since the IPS meeting on August 18th.
Okay, thank you, Madam Clerk. Okay, with that, and just a reminder with respect to public comment, again, to reiterate some of the things I said at the beginning of this meeting, what we do Monday night is will simply constitute our recommendation to the full city council. The full city council will in all likelihood conduct a public hearing after appropriate consultation with the Puyallup tribe. And then ultimately the full council will take action on non-interim regulations. And once all that's through, those non-interim regulations will stay in place until the sub-area plan gets complete. Steve said it's going to be done next year, knock on wood. And when that's complete, it will supersede all the non-interim regulations. There's lots more public process to be had. So with that, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
All right. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All right. See you at 3:45 Monday. Bye. Thanks.